طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر، من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinians' struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we will take a look at Israel as an apartheid state seen through the eyes of two Jewish Israelis. They each describe some of the elements that make the state classically apartheid. Of course, the Israeli government and leadership vigorously deny that Israel is an apartheid state, but have little to say when they are faced with the discriminatory laws, policies, and actions that define the state. Rather than argue about whether Israel is an apartheid state or not, we will look at what is happening on the ground and allow you to make up your own mind on the issue. The first observation comes through an interview with economist and journalist Shir Hever, originally recorded on the Real News Network, as he describes what he experienced in a recent trip back to Israel. Here is that interview.
This is the Real News Network. I'm Sharmini Peres, coming to you from Baltimore. Last week, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was forced to instruct his defense minister to shelf a project segregating the bus lines for Palestinians and Israeli settlers, due to heavy condemnation from several Israeli politicians as well as human rights organizations. Nevertheless, racial profiling and discriminatory inspections at checkpoints, airports, and bus terminals remain normalized in Israeli society under the banner of security. Here to discuss this with us is Shir Hever. He recently returned from Israel, but today he is joining us from Göttingen, Germany. He, as you know, is an economic researcher in the Alternative Information Center, a Palestinian-Israeli organization active in Jerusalem and Beit Shor. Shir, as always, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Sharmini.
Shir, you just recently returned to Israel after a few years. When you return in this way, certain things stand out upon your return. What did you observe?
I think when somebody enters Israel, it takes exactly 5 seconds to see the first manifestation of apartheid. As soon as you leave the airplane, you see there are security guards with shiny vests who pick from the people leaving the aircraft people who seem like young foreigners, the highest risk group for political activists who might be coming to Israel-Palestine in order to protest. And they are immediately taken aside and interrogated by these security guards, while the rest of the passengers can just walk by. That's the first instance that you see, only 5 seconds after disembarking from the plane, how apartheid is being implemented in Israel. But that is actually not very new. This policy has been in place for about 10 years now. What is interesting is how many of the segregation policies that were implemented on the street level, on day-to-day lives of Israelis, have been rolled back a bit in a way that it doesn't affect the entire population, but it focuses specifically on people that look like they might be Arabs, people with dark skin. And that's something that you see very clearly in the central bus terminal, of Jerusalem, Israel's biggest city. The central bus terminal is one of the most fortified locations in Israel. It has airport-level security where people just wanting to take the bus have to have their luggage scanned by machines, and they have to be inspected individually by the security guards. But now, all the security guards stand on the side and just look at the people coming into the building. And if these people look like they have dark skin, like they might be Palestinians, they're taken aside and they have to go through all the scans and show their documents. But people who don't look like that are just waved through. Now, this is something that has been called in apartheid South Africa, small apartheid. There's been a very interesting article just the other day by an Israeli jurist that mentioned this distinction between small apartheid and big apartheid in South Africa, where the small apartheid is something is what you see, like segregated benches, separate water fountains, that sort of thing, while the big apartheid is the segregation in human rights and in the freedom of movement. That's actually much more significant. What we saw with the Minister of Defense decision to have segregated bus lines so that Palestinians would not be allowed to get on the same bus as Israelis. When I say Israelis, I should be a bit more clear. We're talking about colonists in the illegal colonies in the West Bank. This regulation seems to make this small apartheid, where you have segregation on the daily life, too much to bear. And you said before this policy was canceled because of pressure by human rights organizations and by Israeli politicians. But in fact, it's not that there is a big outrage in the Israeli public against such a blatant racism. The worry of these people who spoke up against this policy is how it would look to the rest of the world. How will the world react when this apartheid would become so visible? Well, it's a bit absurd, because the apartheid is already completely visible. Anyone who visits Israel-Palestine will see it. You see it in Jerusalem, you see it in Tel Aviv, you see it on the street, you see it wherever you go. There is simply segregation between the different populations. Palestinians are not allowed to travel freely inside Israel, while Israelis have a lot of freedom of movement, and they can enter even into the West Bank and walk almost
wherever. One of the things that the New York Times reported is that that Prime Minister Netanyahu seemed to be surprised by the introduction of this pilot project, as they put it, and I was wondering whether this was in fact true, and also whether this is a result of having had to appoint the kind of people he's had to in his cabinet as he took office.
Well, in the previous government, the same Minister of Defense has implemented the same policy. To say that Netanyahu was surprised is very unlikely, because he knew that his defense minister, Moshe Yaalon, has already tried to implement this policy once. And it failed precisely because of the same reason, because it was immediately covered by a lot of international newspapers and international news agencies, where they said, well, this is obviously apartheid. Segregation based on race and ethnicity is something that maybe should not exist anymore in modern society. And they had to scuttle the project. The pressure to come forward with this kind of project comes from the right-wing organizations representing the colonists in the West Bank. They are claiming that the mere presence of Palestinians on the bus is a threat to their security, is making their bus ride uncomfortable or unpleasant, and they want the Palestinians out of their sight. And Moshe Yaalon, the Minister of Defense, was simply acquiescing to their pressure, and this is the second time he's doing that. And I think he believed that after the recent elections, the Israeli government is now more right-wing. The Israeli public has given a vote of confidence to the extreme right in Israel, so that the public will be willing to accept this policy, which almost passed already in the previous government. But I think Moshe Yaalon himself is a bit of an odd character here, because he himself is not part of those colonist organizations. The colonist organizations want to have segregation in the buses, but they want to have it everywhere. They want to say that all of what they call Israel, which includes all the occupied territory, which includes all of Palestine, they want to say all of this belongs to Jews, and only to Jews, and Palestinians should be only tolerated under extreme security conditions. And yet Moshe Yaalon, however, made a statement defending his policy, in which he said, why is it so strange that Israel wants to have security checks for people entering its borders, like any other country would want to check people entering its borders? His statement, which he gave to the Jerusalem Post, was very surprising, because he tacitly admitted that the Palestinian territory in the West Bank is not part of Israel. And that's something that the colonists who pushed for this policy certainly didn't want to happen. And I think Netanyahu didn't want this kind of statement either.
Now, finally, does this have anything to do with the European Minister for Foreign Affairs arriving in Israel? By this, I mean the way in which Netanyahu has dealt with this in asking for it to be retracted.
Well, Netanyahu is certainly very good at political timing. He understands that in the European Union, there's been discussions brewing over implementing sanctions against Israel, trying to force Israel to recognize its obligations under international law and to make Israel accountable for the violations. But the European foreign ministers have said we have to wait until the elections. We can't be seen as if we are interfering in the political process in another country. So we will wait with all of these discussions and all of these possible sanctions. Now the elections are over. There's a new government. It has just been approved. And there's nothing to keep the European Union from pushing forward its policy. Netanyahu doesn't want this particular moment to be marred with a very obvious and shocking violations of human rights.
That was economist and journalist Shir Hever, as recorded by the Real News Network. The second look at apartheid is through the eyes of Jeff Halper, who heads the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. Jeff is an anthropologist and former professor at Ben-Gurion University. We have featured Jeff Halper several times in the past on This Week in Palestine, and while most of his former addresses were to American audiences, this particular address was recently made to an audience in Bremen, Germany. Here is Jeff Halper discussing the apartheid state of Israel.
I want to kind of give us a certain picture of where we are with the conflict. And then I want to walk you through a house demolition, because this isn't simply an abstract political discussion, but this is a conflict with an occupation that tremendously affects the lives of Palestinians. We focus on the issue of house demolitions because it gives us a window to understand how Israel is actually conducting its occupation after almost a half century. It certainly lets us understand what Israel's intentions are, where it's going in this conflict. I'm an anthropologist by profession. We approach the world from the ground up. I see what's happening on the ground, and if that doesn't agree with what the politicians are saying, then I go with what they're doing on the ground rather than with what they're saying. Now, this is a conflict that is not merely a local fight between Israelis and Palestinians. If it was merely that, it wouldn't be so important for us. But first of all, it's a conflict that challenges our whole aspiration to try to move from a world that's run by militarism and power to a world run, an inclusive world run on the basis of human rights and international law. And that challenge to human rights is supported by the German government. Israel, with its occupation, is supported by Europe, the United States, and much of the international community. So if Israel wins, and that's a possibility, and an entire people is permanently imprisoned, it sends a chilling message to all the other oppressed peoples of the world that you have nothing really to protect you. The Israel-Palestine conflict also disrupts the entire Middle East. And there's also a major German component to this story. Besides the absolute support that Germany gives to Israel in its occupation, you know, for Israel, the entire international community is reduced to two bodies that matter: American Congress and Germany. If we have those two bodies on our side, we win. Nobody can touch us. So not only does Germany support Israel uncritically, but it's supplying some pretty major weapons to Israel as well. This is one of 9 nuclear-capable submarines that Germany is supplying Israel. Why a country of 8 million people needs 9 nuclear submarines is really a question we should be asking. It's obviously not to fight the Palestinians. 2 or 3 of the nuclear submarines are gifts of the German people to Israel. So in the name of the Israeli people, I want to thank you very much for that. It's exactly what we wanted for our birthday. Okay. Now, this whole conflict that is so disruptive and so damaging to everyone actually has an easy, simple solution. This is a map of what we call the two-state solution. And it's based on a very simple idea, that in this one country between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River, there live 2 peoples. So the idea is 2 states for 2 peoples. Now, if you look at the map, it's obvious that the division isn't exactly equal. It's not exactly 50-50. In fact, Israel, in the two-state solution, is on 78% of the country. And the Palestinians, if they got every centimeter of the occupied territory, which is the West Bank of the Jordan River, East Jerusalem, including the Old City, and Gaza, if they got everything, it would only be 22% of historic Palestine. Even though the Palestinians today are half the population of this country, the Palestinians never get credit for the generous offer that they made to Israel. In 1988, 27 years ago, the PLO accepted the two-state solution. And it's still the plan of the Palestinian Authority, of Abbas, of Abu Mazen. In other words, the majority population said to Israel, we will make peace with you for less than a quarter of our land. Even though we're the majority, we will recognize you and make peace with you for only 22% of our historic homeland. Now, the two-state solution was adopted unanimously by the Arab League in 2002. It was called the Arab Peace Initiative. And the two-state solution is the solution of the international community, including Germany. So you have a solution that is actually super pro-Israeli, that everyone has agreed on, except Israel. Israel says no. As a matter of fact, yesterday, and it was in the headlines, I think even in German newspapers, Netanyahu said there will never be a Palestinian state. Why? How can you explain that? How can you explain Israel, that says it wants peace and security, rejecting an offer that gives it that plus 78% of the country? There are two main explanations. One is that Israel wants the entire country. It's all the land of Israel, and it all belongs exclusively to the Jewish people. And Israel has the power to take the Palestinian land. And it does it with the support of Germany. So if you can have 100% of the land, why would you compromise on 78%? I mean, the European Union and the German government are not happy with the occupation. So Israel has to make its control immune to international pressures. And that it does by laying over the occupied territory what it calls facts on the ground. Now, all these blue blotches all over are Israeli settlements. There's 200 Israeli settlements in the occupied territory. 600,000 Israelis live in the occupied Palestinian territory. In 4 years, there'll be 1 million. And Israel and the settlements exist, you see, in all this gray area that's called Area C, which is 62% of the occupied territory. We don't use the word West Bank in Israel. We talk about Judea and Samaria. So areas A, B, and Gaza are 38% of the occupied territory. So let me tell you where we are. 95% of the Palestinians live on 38% of 22% of their country. And that is fragmented into more than 70 little islands. And all those islands are surrounded by Israeli checkpoints. There are 600 Israeli checkpoints all through the West Bank and East Jerusalem. So it's clear from the facts on the ground that Israel has no intention of going towards a two-state solution. Israel built a wall just to be the last nail in the coffin of a two-state solution. Now, with all due respect, our wall is a wall. Your wall was 4 meters high. Our wall is 8 meters.
You are the winner.
Our wall is 5 times longer than your wall was. And your wall was linear. It went like this. Our wall imprisons tens of thousands of Palestinians in cells. And the wall has nothing whatsoever to do with security. Now, here's where the house demolition policy comes into play. Like I said, Israel wants to push the Palestinians out of Area C into these cells of A and B. So let me show you how it's done. This is the Shoamri family. Salim, Arabia, and their 7 kids. They're children of refugees that were driven out of Israel in 1948. After they were married, they went to Saudi Arabia for 10 years, where Salim worked as a construction engineer. When the Oslo peace process began in 1993, they decided, like thousands of other Palestinians, to come home to help rebuild their country. So they bought a little plot of land in the town of Anata, which is right next to Jerusalem. Then they had to apply to the Israeli authorities for a building permit to build the home. Israel has a policy of not allowing Palestinians to build new homes since 1967. Salim and Arabia, who were desperate for a house, applied 3 times to the Israeli authorities for a permit. Each time it cost them 5,000 euros. And of course they were refused. So like thousands of Palestinian families, they were forced to build a small home for themselves without a permit. And immediately they were given a demolition order by the Israeli Civil Administration. So the family lived for 5 years in their home. One day in July 1998, they were having lunch. And there was a knock on the door. Now, I don't know what civil servants look like in Bremen. But this is what they look like if you're a Palestinian. These are two employees of the civil administration. This is Rami and this is Mika, accompanied by dozens of soldiers. They're civilians. In other words, these are Israeli Jews living on stolen Palestinian land, committed to getting Arabs out of our country, who are put in a position of power to decide which Palestinian can have a home and who's going to be demolished. Salim answered the door. Rami says to him, "Is this your house?" Salim says, "Yes, it's my house." Rami says, "No, it isn't. It's our house now. You have 15 minutes to get your belongings out. We're going to demolish it." In all the commotion, Arabia managed to slam the door shut and lock it with her and the kids inside. And that's when she started to call us and anybody else she could think of. So the soldiers broke the windows of the house and threw in tear gas canisters to get the family out. I don't know if you've ever smelled tear gas outside, but inside, it's overwhelming. Then they broke in the door, and Arabia was taken out unconscious. The kids running and screaming in every direction. Now multiply this 60,000 times. Israel's demolished 60,000 Palestinian homes in the occupied territory since 1967. So you begin to get the idea of the impact this has on Palestinian society. And then we come in as Israeli activists, if we can get there in time. We resist the demolition of Palestinian homes. We chain ourselves in the houses. We get on the roof if we can. We get in front of bulldozers, which is why I'm built this way. And we resist. We're calling journalists. We're calling diplomats. We're calling activists to come out. We've lost this house. But they've come to demolish maybe 10 homes. Salim and Arabia's house was the fifth house they demolished that day. That's why it was in the middle of the day. So if we can resist and people start to come, the army doesn't want people to see what's going on, and they'll withdraw. And maybe we'll have saved 4, 5, 6 houses that day. Now we're out of the house, the family's out of the house, and then the bulldozer comes to demolish the home. Comes through the wall that Salim built and the garden he planted. Israel has convinced governments, the media, the public, that everything it does is for self-defense. We're fighting terrorism. But look, there's nothing security in this story. Of the 60,000 homes, almost none of them were demolished for security reasons. This is a proactive policy of taking Palestinian land and displacing them. So Israel turns the whole thing on its head. We're the victims. We Israelis are the victim. We're the fourth largest nuclear power in the world. We have 9 German nuclear submarines. We're an occupying power for the last 50 years. But we're Jews. So we're the victims. And Salim and the Palestinians are the perpetrators. They're the bad guys. So looking at house demolitions really shows us what the real power relations are. So what we do as an Israeli organization is to rebuild homes that have been demolished. We rebuild homes as political acts of resistance. You see, here's the tent that the Palestinian family gets when their home is demolished from the Red Crescent Society. And we begin to rebuild the home as an act of political resistance. We've built 187 Palestinian homes over the last 14 years. Now, if this was humanitarian, it would be meaningless. There was 187 out of 60,000. But if you look at this politically, 187 joint acts of resistance of Palestinians and Israelis together, that's much more meaningful. We work through Palestinian organizations like the Land Defense Committee. This is maklube, the Palestinian national dish. So it takes us weeks to build a home. We're really working together and in political solidarity, but also getting to know each other. Here's Arabia between two Israeli women rebuilding her home. This is a woman who's traumatized, who's scared, who's never met an Israeli who wasn't a soldier. And here come Israelis to help her build her home. So it's not only political solidarity, but it's very important personal support as well. And we begin to get the house up. And the house is up. You can see the scaffolding. And we just poured the concrete for the roof the night before. But demolition orders are forever. And I had a feeling they're going to come back the next day to demolish the home again. So we spent the night out there that night. And sure enough, 4:30 in the morning, the soldiers and the civil administration come back to demolish the home. Here's Micha, the bulldozers, the soldiers, and the home is demolished again. Salim's face kind of says it all. We didn't even have a chance to drink our coffee yet in the morning. We're not going to let the occupation win. If they demolish 100 times, we're going to rebuild the home 101 times. And we got a small house up again. The family moved in. And the next day, the civil administration came back again to demolish. And the story repeats itself. Micha, the workers sent in to take out the furniture. And the home is demolished again. This time by a pneumatic drill in order to dig up the foundations so we couldn't rebuild. And the home is gone yet again. Salim says the demolition of a home is really the demolition of a family. Men, women, and children react very differently to a demolition. For men, it's a humiliating, emasculating experience. A man can't protect his family, he can't provide shelter for his family, but at least men can get out in society to vent. They can get their anger out. For women, it's a very different situation. It's a double tragedy. Most Palestinian women don't work outside of the home. So for them, the home, the domestic sphere, defines them as people, as women, as mothers, as wives. And then there's the kids. This is Lena, Salima Aramia's daughter. During one of the demolitions, she went blind. All of a sudden, she couldn't see. We put her in the car, and we rushed her to the hospital. In the hospital, as she started to calm down a bit, her sight began to come back. And the doctor explained that it was a kind of hysterical blindness. When your mind can't process what's going on, it simply shuts down. And it was lucky that her sight came back on its own. So you can imagine the trauma that these kids are living throughout Palestinian society. Now, I'm not going to continue the story, but Salima Arabia's home was demolished 6 times. And we rebuilt it each time. On one of the houses, we put this mural. It's a dead Caterpillar bulldozer on a pile of dead weapons. And there are the figures of two women hovering over the scene who died in demolitions. Last year, the Israeli army demolished Salima Arabia's house twice. Once in January, we rebuilt in the summer, and again in November. This time they came in the middle of the night and threw the family out of the house. This is what we found in the morning. All the belongings again thrown out. And the story continues. Now, of the 187 homes, 175 still stand. Knock on wood. Where are we in terms of this terrible conflict? It seems to me there's three possible solutions. One of them is the two-state solution that everyone accepted, except Israel. This is still the option, the solution pursued by Germany and by the EU. But if you look at the maps and the facts on the ground, and you go there, it's clear that the two-state solution is gone. No one is going to force 600,000 Israelis with all their cities and highways out of the occupied territory. So that leads us to the second possible solution, and that's apartheid, like in South Africa. Israel has eliminated the two-state solution. It did it deliberately and systematically over decades. So Israel has created in this country one state. There is one state today between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River. There's only one effective governmental authority in this whole area, and that's the Israeli government. Obviously, there's only one army. There's only one currency. Whether you're in Gaza or Nablus or Tel Aviv, we're all using the shekel, all controlled by the Bank of Israel. There's only one highway system, one water system, one electrical system. By every measure, this is today one country. But it's an apartheid country. It's clear that it's Israel over the Palestinians. And I use the word apartheid in a very precise way. In international law, apartheid means two things. There's two elements to apartheid. One is when one population separates itself from the others. That's the apart. And then that population creates a regime of permanent domination. And that's clearly what we have in this country. This is a solution that Israel wants. Israel says, we won. It's over. We have control of the entire country. The Palestinians are imprisoned in these little islands. We've pacified them more or less. And we've done all this with the support of Germany and the Europeans. Unlike South Africa, we can succeed in having an apartheid state. It could be that Israel has managed to create an apartheid situation that's very stable and that the international community can live with. Concepts of justice, human rights, international law are not parts of government policies. As the nuclear submarines show, governments work only by power. And Israel can be a military ally of Germany, not the Palestinians. So we have to say, apartheid is not an acceptable solution to us. And that leaves us to advocate the third solution. And that is, we say to Israel, okay, you won. This is now one country. You made it one country. You destroyed the two-state solution. And we accept that. But now, we don't accept apartheid. So we're going to take the one state that you, Israel, created, and we're going to make it a democratic state of equal rights for all its citizens. Israel, you have a choice. You can be kind of a Jewish state if you accept the two-state solution. But the minute you decide to take all the land in the country and incorporate 4.5 million Palestinians, you have to give them equal rights. And so our job is to turn Israel-Palestine into a democratic state of all the peoples living there.
That was Jeff Halper of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions in an address recorded in Bremen, Germany. Before leaving you this morning, we want to report the following stories out of Palestine this week. The International Middle East Media Center, the source of much of our news here at This Week in Palestine, reports that there has been no humanitarian or economic progress in the Gaza Strip since the National Consensus Government was formed a year ago by Hamas and Fatah, the major Palestinian political parties. According to the Ma'an News Service, the leader of Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, says that the situation in Gaza has not changed at all due to the ongoing Israeli blockade, as well as a lack of reconstruction, crisis in providing money for salaries, and ongoing shortages in water and electricity. Last June, a government consensus was formed, and Haniyeh said he had hoped that a unity government would start taking as much responsibility for Gaza as it does for the West Bank. Haniyeh says the government was given three main objectives in the Cairo agreement: ending the blockade and accomplishing reconstruction, working on uniting Palestinian Authority institutions in the two parts of Palestine, and preparing for legislative, presidential, and national council elections. And that after a year, not one of these objectives has been met. He said he still believes that the government has a chance to meet its objectives and represent all Palestinians indiscriminately, as well as to treat the West Bank and the Gaza Strip equally. Despite this, the relationship between Hamas, led by Haniyeh, and Fatah, led by Abbas, is continuing to decline. Haniyeh also said he encourages visits to Gaza by international councils and ambassadors, saying that exploratory visits allow people to witness the tragedy Gazans face. He says the visits bring practical results that reduce the suffering of the people in Gaza. He stated that he believes these delegations, especially the German delegation, will speed up reconstruction and help end the blockade, as well as help pressure the Israeli government to end its aggressive attitude toward civilians. Haniyeh says the people are in dire need of economic aid, but it can only be achieved if Israel ends the blockade on the Strip. At the current rate, it would take up to 100 years for Gaza to be reconstructed. In this from the United Nations, a push is currently being made to add the Israeli military to the blacklist of the UN Council for Children in Armed Conflict. The special representative of the Secretary General for Children in Armed Conflict, Leila Zarugi of Armenia, has recommended that the Israeli army be added to the list because of some 500 Palestinian children killed and 3,300 wounded during last summer's Operation Protective Edge. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon seems likely to resist the call, particularly in light of heavy opposition from Israel and threats that such a move could fully terminate relations between Israel and the UN. However, Palestinian pressure abounds not only from the Palestinian Authority, but also its supporters and human rights groups. UN Secretariat officials also back the Palestinians and have urged Bonn not to give in to Israeli threats. One ally Israel likely can count on is the United States. Discussing the issue with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham warned that continued mistreatment of the Israeli state would result in a violent pushback against the UN. Graham threatened to cut all American funding to the United Nations should it continue to function in a manner that marginalizes Israel. Israel's response, meanwhile, was deservedly angry, with foreign minister officials condemning the UN's bias against the Jewish state. And finally, a new website is publicizing the identities of pro-Palestinian student activists to prevent them from getting jobs after they graduate from college. But the website is keeping its own backers' identity a secret. It is your duty to ensure that today's radicals are not tomorrow's employees, a female narrator intones in a slick video posted on the website's YouTube account. Called the Canary Mission, the site has posted profiles of dozens of students and recent graduates, alongside those of well-known activists like Omar Barghouti, founder of the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement. Some of the students are active in Students for Justice in Palestine. Others were involved in recent pro-BDS resolutions on campuses in California. Many of them have relatively thin activist resumes. The focus on young people and students is an effort to try to tell people that there will be a price for you taking a political position, said Ali Abu Nima, founder of the pro-Palestinian website The Electronic Intifada. It's an effort to punish and deter people from standing up for what they believe, he said. Daniel Pipes, president of the Middle East Forum, defended the tactic as a way of forcing people to understand the seriousness of their political stance. Factually documenting who one's adversaries are and making this information available is a perfectly legitimate undertaking, Pipes wrote in an email. Collecting information on students has a particular value because it signals them that attacking Israel is serious business and not some inconsequential game, and that their actions can damage both Israel and their future careers. Despite its dedication to documenting the identities of pro-Palestinian activists, Canary Mission seems to have gone to great lengths to keep the identity of its own members and backers well hidden. There are no names of Canary Mission staff members, volunteers, donors, or allies on the site. The web domain is registered in a way that hides its ownership. Though the site says that Canary Mission is a non-profit organization, no group called Canary Mission is currently registered with the IRS as eligible to receive tax-deductible contributions, and the website indicates no fiscal sponsorship through which it can accept donations. And so the Zionist pushback continues. Evidence of the effectiveness of the pro-Palestinian movement on campus. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. Or listen to us at any time via the archive found on the WZBC homepage. Simply click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. Each program is on this archive for 2 weeks. To reach our permanent archive, to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. It is all there. Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts, and this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.